Welcome back to The Kicker. I'm Josh Hirsch, an editor at the Columbia Journalism Review. It's a great time to be a sports fan. Major League Baseball is finally back. The NFL draft is right around the corner. March Madness is in full swing. And everywhere you look, there are shows and podcasts and documentaries featuring your favorite players, giving analysis, and even behind-the-scenes peeks at what their lives are really like. But if independent investigative news is what you're after, well, you might have a harder time finding it. Over the past year, numerous beloved sports news institutions have been shut down or dramatically reduced their operations. Sports Illustrated, Deadspin, the New York Times Sports Section, Outside the Lines, Real Sports on HBO, all gone, or close enough. My guest this week is Josh Fine. He was an investigative producer at Real Sports for 17 years. He has some ideas about how sports journalism can revive itself. But in the meantime, he'll tell us why he's keeping a close eye on everything from the rise of sports betting to the foreign nations buying up professional teams. It's so nice to have you here. Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, God, it's a pleasure. Thanks for focusing on this topic. I'm grateful. And it's always nice to be back at Columbia.
You spent a very long time at Real Sports at HBO. You had quite a run there.
I did. I was at HBO for almost 20 years. The first few years at Bob Costas had a show. And then for the last 17 years at Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. And it's funny, at the sort of goodbye party, both Brian and the executive producer of the show, Joe Persky, talked about how so many of us spent so much time there that, you know, like the kids were born and the, you know, kids grew up and the kids left for college. And, you know, it was one of those jobs that was so good and so rare that you didn't ever want to leave.
Yeah. Did you know the end was coming? I mean, was that sort of, was the writing on the wall for a little while?
There was concern. I think we were all concerned, but we did not know it was coming. And I remember when Bryant sent out a note to us that he was retiring, as it were, and the show was ending. I was at I'm on the board of this thing called the Overseas Press Club, and I was at a meeting of it, and I remember just chatting with some of my fellow board members, and the email comes in, and I remember being like physically ill. And so so I guess I hadn't internalized that it really could come, even though of course intellectually I knew that it was possible.
What was Real Sports for someone who's not familiar with the show? How would you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of modeled on 60 Minutes. So it was a, you know, what they call it, a television news magazine. And it was really similar to the 60 Minutes model, which ironically I worked at before I came to Real Sports. So, you know, 12 to maybe at the high end 24 minute pieces. And it was a monthly show. Re-aired, I think, like 20 times between its air date and its the next one a month later. But we had 3 to 4 pieces each month. So we would do roughly like 33 new pieces a year. And
it was sports, but as news. It took sports very seriously as a news product, essentially, as a thing that there was a responsibility to cover, like news.
Absolutely. You know, I'd say broadly, we tended to have like three types of stories. One would be like an issue story. Another would be maybe a softer kind of, you know, profile-y or travel story. Again, this is really the 60 Minutes model. And then the other would be like an investigative piece, which is what I was lucky enough to work on a lot of those. And we were given the time and resources to really work on those, and both at the pre-production and post-production level. But the pre-production stuff is really, I think, made it unique. I mean, we could take months researching stories, you know, filing open records requests, going and, you know, meeting with potential interviewees. We had sort of a healthy budget and a lot of really seasoned journalists working there. And
yeah.
so
Because one of the things that is a knock on television news, even at its best, is that there's a degree of like, okay, this has been reported by someone else. We're just going to go make the TV version of it. And you're describing a process that probably had as many misses as it had hits too, right? Pieces that just never even got made.
Cause... Oh, God. I mean, I think my boss used to say that he would look at, I think he may have said 1,000. That sounds high, but like maybe that's true. Like 1,000, like anyway, hundreds of, I mean, it was at least a, I don't know, 20-30 to 1 ratio of things that would get floated and then things that would get made. And it was it was an incredible place to learn, even as sort of a mid-career journalist, which is where I joined. Like, you know, they would really work you over in terms of, you know, before you went out and shot anything, you would do most of the time like these sort of write-ups. They were like mini Atlantic pieces or something, you know, 5, 6, 8 pages where you know, and then you would get kind of murder boarded, if you will, on like, you know, do you have the goods? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how are you going to tell the story? And I felt really lucky to work there.
Did you feel throughout the process like this is sort of an outlier in the world of sports? I mean, obviously, you know, part of what's happening right now is Real Sports is gone, Outside the Lines is gone, another show that did some similar kinds of work. We've seen a real contraction in the space for this kind of journalism. But I also wonder to some extent if it was something you were aware of even at the time that, you know, in the world of sports, there isn't a culture necessarily of this kind of in-depth investigations.
Yeah. I mean, on the TV side, you had, ESPN has always had a pretty robust investigative unit. Some of that stuff was not necessarily what they call long form. So it was, you know, and there's obviously a great need for all of this, right? But they also did have, like you mentioned, they had Outside the Lines, which was more of sort of a long form show. 60 Minutes for a while had a show, not for a while, but for I think 2 or 3 seasons, they had something called 60 Minutes Sports. So there were a few other things.
I forgot about that. 60 Minute Sports.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So there were some other things. I think we had been at it longer. I think that's fair to say. Mm-hmm. One thing we tried to do, you know, really look at like structural issues in sports, right? So we kind of became like subject matter experts.
What are you thinking of?
One I did that comes immediately to mind was on the NCAA basically didn't provide post-college care for its athletes. So you had guys who would get injured in football games, you know, playing for their school, would have, you know, lifelong or certainly long-term injuries as a result of those, head injuries, body injuries, all sorts of things that were clearly going to take, you know, require decades of medical treatment. You see what happens to NFL players, right?
You know, but you're talking about college kids,
exactly,
who until very recently weren't getting paid.
Well, right.
Process,
I mean, they're
right?
still sort of not getting paid. They're at least not. They're not directly. But anyway, they weren't. In addition to not getting paid, They didn't have any. They didn't have any post-college medical care that the NCAA required of these schools, and almost none of them were providing it. A couple of them were giving it for like a couple years. I think now they've extended it to like 4 years or something. But I think that's the kind of thing where so you're like, okay, this is something that is impacting you know, a lot of people where so we know what the issue is, so to speak.
And so this is an interesting point to think of yourself as like, do you think of yourself as a sports journalist now, or do you think of yourself as an investigative reporter who happened to do sports for a very long time?
I guess more the latter, to the extent there's a big distinction. But
part of why I'm asking is like thinking going ahead, could you just walk away from sports, or do you feel like there's a sort of need to make sure that something like this continues to exist in the world of sports?
I think it's important. I mean, I think that there's a kind of deficit currently of investigative sports journalism, certainly on television. And
a deficit, I mean, maybe even an absence almost entirely.
Yeah,
right?
I think that's probably right. But yeah, I think that's a big problem. It's a massive industry, right? It's like, depending on, you know, it's like a $1 trillion global industry, something like 2% of global GDP or something like that. It's the big players in it are these kind of like self-regulated cartels, you know. So you have these like kind of monopolies that control, like, you know, the NCAA controls college sports, the NFL controls something called American football, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
And by the way, I just want to stop. I mean, that's a big word to throw around, but I don't think you throw it around casually. I mean,
this is certainly not like a conclusion of mine. I think this is what most law professors or just people who've looked at this, right? I mean,
there's a reason the NFL gets hauled in front of Congress, right? Because it's got this sort of special exemption to antitrust kind of things, right?
I
don't want to get too sidelined.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think my point is that I think sometimes people don't think about actually what we're talking about here, which is, whether you want to call it a cartel or a just like blatant antitrust violation, you have these organizations that have an immense, immense power and are, like you say, self-regulating to a large
degree. I don't think they're violating any laws. I think that this is, I mean, I think the laws historically, I mean, you have like the antitrust exemption that Major League Baseball got like in the 20s or 30s, and then there's these subsequent cases from like the 60s and 70s that sort of allow the other leagues to kind of operate. I'm like a little out of my depth on all of the legal minutiae here, but like in effect, you know, you and I can't start a baseball team and say we want to compete against the Yankees, right? Like, you know, MLB controls who's in something called Major League Baseball, right?
Right.
You know, like in Europe, there's like ministries of sport that play some kind of like oversight role. We don't have that here. And also in Europe, the public broadcasters get engaged in a lot of this. So the BBC and the ARD in Germany and whatnot. And so we don't really have like a public infrastructure to sort of look after these entities. And so, you know, that's really where investigative reporting is needed. I mean, just as a society, we sort of count on investigative reporters, accountability journalism, whatever word you want to use, to sort of provide that oversight function. So yeah, I think it's hugely important, and you know, it's certainly an industry that historically has done things that have had a real, you know, negative impact, you know, on the country in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, and what do you say to people who would say, "Well, it's just a game, right? We're just having fun. This is just they're just people having a good time, you know? Why do you have to be such a naysayer about it?"
I mean, you know, I like sports like anyone else. I was thinking the other night of that scene in Broadcast News when Holly Hunter's showing the film of the domino race, and she's like, you know, everyone's laughing, and she's like, "Yeah, it's fun. I like fun. It's just not news." You know, so these are heavily publicly subsidized entities, right? Mm-hmm. And so we just, especially as like a journalism community, like, you know, publicly subsidized, self-regulated cartels, like that's the kind of thing we say, okay, like this is our role in a society, is to provide some, like, you know, investigative function in that environment. And and the absence of that, you know, I mean, that creates big problems. And you know, you have like, I think something like 8 million boys and girls play high school sports, you know, far more than that play youth sports. You know, there's a massive industry that touches all of us. And, you know, there used to be newspapers would refer to sports, this is going back a while, but they would refer to sports as the toy department.
Yes. You
know, they don't
yes.
do that anymore. But there's still a little bit of a notion. And you know, you cover the games too. I mean, if you look at like the way sort of the White House is covered by the big papers, you know, they'll have like people who are sort of positioned there and are maybe keeping good relations with the White House staff, and they may not be, you know, breaking the investigative stories per se. They may be, but like, you know, there's some access component that's understood, I think. And then there's just a team of other reporters back at, you know, headquarters doing, you know, deep dive investigations. I'm oversimplifying, but like you can certainly have that in sports, right? Like, you know, if the person who's going to be embedded with the New York Mets, you know, traveling around the country, that person may be, to the extent he or she is breaking stories, it may be about so-and-so is injured or something, you know, like
trades and personnel things.
Yeah, exactly. It may not be. I mean, and that person may have the opportunity to break bigger stories as well. But there's some.
But if they want to prioritize the relationship with the team and that's something that's providing a service for the audience, that's okay because in addition to it, you have this other. This is an idealized sort
yeah,
of a
yeah.
User.
I think that's understood by some of the big papers, and you have. You know, I think the Washington Post has like 5 or 6 investigative sports reporters now, yeah. which is great. You know,
I hear a lot of praise for that particular paper sports department.
I generally speaking, the upside of doing investigative sports reporting, there's the sort of like public value of it. So I think news organizations have a responsibility, and then there's a lot of people who are interested in sports, right? So you have, when you get into some of these sort of racial issues or equity issues or human rights issues, you have this like built-in audience that you may not have for mm-hmm. other topics. You know, I remember talking to, I think it was like Don Van Natter, right? I think I saw Don at a hearing on Capitol Hill, and he and I had both been news guys, and then we went into sports. And we joked about how when we did news stories, there was like no pickup from it and nobody would write about it afterwards. And then in sports, it was like, it would have this like echo, it would just get a lot of play. So, I mean, the public money stuff is, this is one of the big reasons I'm concerned about sort of the dearth of investigative sports journalism. I mean, you have the subsidization of the sports leagues, and this is a uniquely American thing. Like, this doesn't exist in Europe. It's just the numbers are extraordinary, and like by some metrics they're like the most subsidized entity on like a per revenue basis of like any industry in the country. And I've been arguing that if the market can't support investigative, I just gave a talk on this at the Sport and Democracy Conference, that like if the market can't support investigative sport journalism, so if there's not going to be shows like Real Sports, or if a lot of these papers are struggling to survive and do any sort of investigative work. So, so they're probably don't have the luxury of having, that maybe the solution to this is for a more philanthropically funded investigative sports journalism sector that in the same way that I think the philanthropic community stepped in 10 or 15 years ago and said, there's a real deficit of investigative reporting. We know that investigative reporting, saves lives, saves money. It has, there's a lot of scholarship on its sort of positive impact for society, really critical impact. So, the best example of this, most listeners will be familiar with, is ProPublica, right? And then after that, you had some like single topic entities like the Markup or the Marshall Project.
Yeah. Comes to mind too.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think there, the philanthropic community, and then you really have this, of course, in what were so-called news deserts, right, where you had communities that had lost any sort of news organization, and you had the philanthropic community coming in. You have this entity called Press Forward now, which is a few big foundations. I think there's like $1 billion pledged to work on this. Traditionally, there's been little to zero support for investigative sports journalism, but I think that there ought to be a reconsideration by the philanthropic community of this. That I think they, the goals they try and achieve with supporting investigative journalism in other areas, supporting democracy and other. Accountability, et cetera. Yeah,
criminal justice reform or whatever
it might be. Yeah, to some degree. I mean, you don't want to, obviously, like, you don't want to cross the advocacy line. But the, that a lot of that is, the investigative sports journalism is critical. It's needed. They can, to the extent they have these sort of goals, it can be achieved through doing sports. So,
yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it certainly feels like a blind spot in a lot of those places. What do you see when you look at the landscape right now? I mean, in the post-Real Sports, post-Outside the Lines moment, like what does the sports news and investigative news landscape in particular look like to you?
When the show ended, the Associated Press wrote, "The fear is that a form of sports journalism is leaving for good." And then John Solomon, who you may know, longtime reporter, now head of the Aspen Institute Sports and Society Program. He said, we've lost media that critically look at how sports positively and negatively impact America while holding people in power accountable.
Yeah.
Not many left doing this work.
Not many, but I mean, maybe, I mean, it's few and far between right now, it feels like.
I feel like you're now the, I want to turn the tables on you because you're like now the expert on this, having done your deep dive.
I don't know that I can, I mean, it's one of those things where I don't know that I can quantify it, you know? I think it just feels like the institutional heft that may have once existed has really largely evaporated. Not entirely, because there are, as you said, there are very good investigative divisions that exist at places. The Washington Post does it. ESPN has some very good investigative reporting. But it feels like the people who are really devoted to doing the kind of deep dive work have been going away. It's been slipping away. And at the same time, we are being flooded, just absolutely flooded, especially on the video side, with content. Content that looks and feels like a documentary or a news talk show, but really is the athletes in the driver's seat, which can be great. It can be really fun, but it can also be really, really dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I've been, when I've talked to some sort of nonprofit journalism folks or philanthropics funders, one of the things I've argued is that this kind of diminution, if you will, of investigative sports journalism is happening at the worst possible time. You know, the industry's growing. It's becoming more and more influenced by these kind of non-democratic states, you know, in the Gulf and China. And, you know, the kind of transparency and openness is going in the wrong direction. And
I mean, here's what I worry about. Here's how I see it in a way that is a little reductionist, I'll confess. But I see a real reduction in the serious investigative news resources going to sports journalism at the same time that we are really truly being bombarded with, and quite fun to watch, honestly, documentary series and behind the scenes kind of reality show things.
Yeah.
But again, they're not called reality. They're called documentary series, you know, that are produced or executive produced by the players who are in them or by other players, in some cases by the leagues entirely. And I think that there are, of course, separate forces at play. Like, the entire journalism world is suffering from a reduction right now, from a contraction, from a lack of deep resources being put into any kind of news at the moment. So it's a painful...
The for-profit spaces, by the way. But I'm not sure that's true if you include the nonprofits.
Sure, you're right. And I think that's an interesting part of what you're trying to achieve, is sort of explore that for sports. But that hasn't existed in sports, right?
That's right.
So, but yes, there are some factors here that I do think apply across the spectrum. But I think uniquely in sports, that space is not obvious to a viewer or to a observer or to a fan. Whereas before, you might have been forced while watching SportsCenter or while perusing, you know, watching HBO and enjoying whatever it was, to be confronted at least with, like, subliminally, at least a sense that, okay, there are really big issues that exist in these sports. Now, like, I don't know, like, LIV Golf is a huge thing. LIV Golf, though, like, there's a huge aspect of LIV being presented in the context of Live being a Saudi-funded venture, right? That's it's being presented in the context of, like, the Netflix series, the reality show that follows golfers around, as just like a competitor and which it is, of course. But, like, you know, you're not getting really deep investigative work out of that.
Yeah.
And audiences, I worry, don't know what they're missing. That's my big fear, that audiences feel like they're getting a kind of access to athletes that they never got before, a kind of sense of something that's like a simulacrum of journalism, but it isn't.
Yeah.
And so they don't know the stories that they're not being told.
Right.
And no one is filling that gap. There isn't a gap.
Yeah. Well, I guess I feel like the things that I'm talking about are so distinct from that, right? I mean, none of what you're talking about is journalism. I mean, I don't think they claim it's journalism.
No.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting that there's, like, something unethical about
right.
it at
yeah,
all
yeah.
because
yeah.
it's entertainment.
Right, right, exactly.
Some of them, I think, would probably say that we're a little more journalistic. But frankly, you know, in calling Netflix and Amazon and some of these distributors who put these shows out, often they don't even really – they don't take issue with the notion that they're – partnering with the athlete to produce the thing because, of course, they are. They're very
right.
open about
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
it doesn't
yeah.
feel like it's not problematic to them.
Right.
They're not trying to be journalistic.
Yeah, yeah exactly.
So,
yeah. I think that only fills an entertainment void or need in society. It doesn't fill information and accountability need. I mean, so it feels very sort of separate and different. I guess I'm trying to focus on the things that can be done. That's not something
yeah.
that the journalism community has any control over. And so if you look at like sort of garden variety investigative reporting, on the public record side, I mean, as someone who spent a year filing public records to high school sports teams, you know, almost every high school in the country is subject to open records requests. Like, that's amazing, right? And most big-time college sports programs are public.
Yep.
Some aren't, but
mm-hmm.
again, it's got to be at least two-thirds, right? Michigan, mm-hmm. Ohio State, et cetera.
Of course.
So, and then you have the municipalities and the public entities, the states and the counties that are subsidizing these sports teams. Those are all public, right? So you can file public entities for them. So incredible access to filing open records requests. On the sort of already public side, a lot of the kind of arguably troubling behavior comes as a result of how a lot of troubling behavior comes through sort of like greasing the wheels politically, right? So,
mm-hmm.
so you know, contributions to campaigns, lobbying records, all this stuff's public. And so, you know, and occasionally someone will do like an amazing piece, like if I'm remembering correctly, like when the Vikings owner was trying to get like $1 billion from the state of Minnesota for a new stadium, like he spent, you know, like he shattered all the records for lobbying in the state. Or I may have some of these facts wrong, but anyway, you know, all you had to do was pull those records there.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
So anyway, it's like it's such a great space to do investigative reporting. So few people are doing it that you have like a lot of this space to yourself on these stories. It's kind of amazing. Like, I remember when I was I worked for Peter Jennings for the investigative unit at World News Tonight at ABC, and then after that at 60 Minutes. And we used to talk about feeling tracks on stories. Like, you know, you start getting your hands into a story, and then you can feel like, oh, there's all these people who you're competing with, all these other news organizations. And so you'd live in fear of getting scooped all the time. And then when I started working in sports, I'd be like, of course, I still had that like muscle memory of fear. And nobody else would be.
Oh,
it was like the craziest thing. I'd go to my bosses and be like, I'm worried someone's going to get out. I'd be like, don't worry about it. No one's going to work out this.
What an upbeat spin on such a kind of dire situation. Oh, what's the next big thing coming? Like, what would you be working on if you were really just all you were doing was sitting at Real Sports working on stories? What would you be
looking
at?
Well, I think this shift in ownership of teams is going to be big. So you have, if you look at like the last 10 or 15 years in Europe, the big soccer teams have been bought up, or many of the big soccer teams have been bought up by the sovereign wealth funds of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the various
mm-hmm.
emirates of the UAE. And if not the sovereign wealth funds, then it's entities within those countries. And there, that has a lot of fascinating impacts on...
I think I just saw, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I just saw a video about a really powerful, like a free agent soccer player, someone who likes soccer is going to be really mad at me about this, but going in to the presidential palace in France to meet with Macron and one of the sovereign, the owners of the team that happens to be a... Hold on, let me Google this.
Yeah,
do,
yeah.
do you have a memory of this, of what I'm talking about?
No, I'm
hold on.
To hear.
Okay, so it's the Emir of Qatar and Macron met with Kylian... I can't pronounce
it. Yeah, Mbappe.
Mbappe, yeah. At the presidential... At the Elysee, at the presidential... You know, and then, like, this is major diplomatic sort of things happening and power behind the scenes, but under the guise of just sort of, you know, athletes moving around from different teams. You know?
So there's a really interesting study that just came out. So the Qataris have owned the big soccer team in France, Paris Saint-Germain, just, you know, like the big power there, sort of the Yankees, if you will, of French soccer. And the Qataris have owned them for a decade or so. And this researcher from that big business school in Paris, he looked at views of PSG fans. That's the Paris Saint-Germain. They're often just called PSG. The views of PSG fans of how they view sort of Qatar as a country on human rights issues and all sorts of things versus how do fans of other teams view them. And, of course, what the Qataris did after they bought PSG is they poured a ton of money into it, and now they, you know, they went from, like, a power to a superpower, right? You know, having the best players in the world. And so you have this interesting ability of this country that's often viewed in a, you know, somewhat negative ways for their human rights abuses and other matters, kind of able to increase their standing, if you will, to sort of diminish some of the negative views.
No, it's an incredible public relations tool.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly powerful one that's totally divorced from your actual policies or actions.
Yeah, and so you have like a really interesting question.
And it creates tremendous pressure for the French president to not alienate, right? Like
Exactly right. And so then you start to, and there's examples of that with other teams in Europe. So then what you have in the U.S. that I think will be very interesting. So for a while you couldn't have foreign ownership, you couldn't have sovereign wealth ownership, et cetera. But the leagues are all starting to loosen those rules. And recently, the Qataris bought like 5% of the Washington Wizards, the NBA team, and the Washington Capitals, the NHL team. And you're going to see more of that over the next few years.
Maybe no accident that it's the DC team, right?
Perhaps not. So I think the question is, you know, to your question of what I'll be watching, like what I would be watching if I was still at Real Sports, I really wonder the impact of all that, you know. Yeah. So does it make it harder, you know, like you said, you know, if you know, can Macron not, does it hamper his ability to put pressure on the Qataris on women's rights issues, LGBTQ rights issues?
Who's showing up in the owner's suite at these Capitals games? What politicians are showing up, and who's tracking that?
Yeah.
And I have to say, by the way, just to go back, I think actually there's an interesting lesson in my bungling of the names and the specifics of this. Anyone listening to me do that will immediately discount me as a person whose opinion is worth hearing about this. I used to cover guns a lot, right? And if you report on gun culture and you call an AR-15 an assault rifle, you know, say AR stands for that, people get really mad in the gun community and they say, we don't have to pay attention to what you're saying. And it brings me back to this conversation we were having earlier where can these topics be covered by the political staff at the Washington Post? Or do you need someone really versed in sports who's also tasked with doing these kind of deep dives?
I think that it helps to have the latter. And here's why. Because the entities are these kind of closed systems, they have this, you know, they're devoid of competition, at least within them. And there's this interesting, you know, kind of weird histories there. It helps to really know it well. It's very hard. It's a little bit like business reporting, right? It's like it really helps to know.
Can we talk about betting for a second?
Sure.
I mean, how concerned are you about betting as what at least has been described to me by some people as really the next major frontier for big problems in sports?
I mean, I guess sort of off the top of my head, there's two things that I worry about. I looked into years ago, there was like a point shaving case with the University of Toledo basketball players. And this was before, you know, widespread sports gambling was legal. But and so, of course, you would expect there to be, you know, much more of that now. The stuff that the colleges were doing is almost like humorous. And it's kind of just sort of remarkable, right? Where you had like the University of Colorado, kind of, you know, having their, do you remember that? They had the banners in the mm-hmm. background of at the stadium for one of the sports betting.
Mm. Sort of brazen. And
what? Tell me, where are your concerns on the sports betting stuff?
I don't know. I think it's a great example of a thing where we don't know what we don't know. Like, you know, like you obviously have an instinct that there can be problems. We know what the ones we can guess are, the Pete Rose's kind of thing, you know, or even a player actually going out of their way to bet on something where it in some way materially affects the game that they're participating
right.
in. Like, I
yeah.
mean, we know that. I don't think we know what we don't know about what's going to come
yeah.
out of it. And that's where I really worry about the dearth of the kinds of people who are really familiar with these players and the games and the leagues, who are there all the time, who are also tasked with doing that kind of really hard-nosed reporting.
Yeah.
Feels like it'll be far too long before it trickles down to the business pages and other people. So,
yeah, and I will say, when I've had some, you know, just initial discussions with folks in the journalism funding community, philanthropic foundations and philanthropists, they almost universally point to that I guess
yeah
they know enough about money to know
yeah
I mean, it is amazing, right, how the leagues and just the driving of interest.
Well, and the worry, it brings me back to sort of like what's taking the place of that kind of journalism. A lot of the sort of new forms of content that are out there right now are heavily funded by
yeah.
gambling right now.
Absolutely.
You know, and you see that in a lot of, like, the fan-sided or whatever, these kind of, like, these pop-up sort of content farmy things have betting tickers on the top of them. ESPN now has I think this is the biggest one, a massive, massive partnership. They have this whole thing, ESPN Bet. They did a four-part series before the Super Bowl that was branded as Outside the Lines, and it had one segment on it. It was about gambling and sort of how the industry has changed. And it had one segment on it that was pretty strong in and of itself. It was a segment about abuses and addiction. And it wasn't, I would not say personally, it was as strong as the 60 Minutes piece that also came out around that time. But it was a pretty good piece. And when I watched it, it was immediately preceded by two ads for betting companies,
right?
And you just whether you can say what the compromises are, you just feel that there are or there are going to be really, really big problems in how this stuff gets covered.
And I mean, relatedly, it's unquestionably leading to the growth of the sports industry, right? So as we were talking about earlier, it's, you know, like roughly 2% of global GDP, about $1 trillion industry. The amount of money that's flow, everyone's betting that it's going up, right? So if you look at the you know, public private equity money that's going into it, and, you know, all of the big firms now, Goldman and Citibank and Chase, you know, they all have like these sports entities that mm-hmm. like help people invest into sports properties. And so everyone's assuming that, even though the sports industry is enormous at this point, right, that it's going to be significantly larger. And so, you know, if anything would speak to the need for robust investigative journalism, right? It's
yeah, it's that flooding of money and
absolutely, yeah. And yeah, largely, and yeah.
Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Appreciate you guys focusing on this important topic.
The Kicker is brought to you by the Columbia Journalism Review and produced by Amanda Dara. I'm your host, Josh Hirsch.